FM and 90.9 FM HD3, Urbana.
This is Keeping the Faith, a weekly discussion about issues of faith, spirituality, religion, and ethics. Now here's your host, Steve Shoemaker.
Welcome to Keeping the Faith. Our guest this afternoon is Professor Eric Freifogel from the University College of Law. Welcome. Now, you sit in a named chair there, the Max L. Rowe, R-O-W-E, Professor of Law. Who is or was Max L. Rowe?
A good friend of the law school.
I'm sure.
And a very significant donor, not just giving money to support faculty there at the law school, but also gave a substantial amount of money to remodel our auditorium, which is named in his honor as well. So he's been a good friend of the university as a whole. He was a practicing lawyer in Chicago for many years.
Oh, well, that auditorium gets very good use, I know. I've been to several wonderful programs there, panel discussions and so forth.
Sure.
Right. We're going to be talking about animals today, wildlife law, animal law. That's one of the sort of a specialty of yours recently. Tell us how you got interested in that.
It probably was an outgrowth of interest in sort of environmental law, natural resources, resources generally.
Uh-huh.
You know, the more I read about conservation thought, about how we ought to be interacting with nature, the more I realized that a key issue was our relationship with wild animals. I mean, a lot of people think that if we are able to live in landscapes in a way that makes them good homes for other species, they're likely to be good homes for us as well in terms of their functioning, their healthiness generally. And a lot of people who write about conservation thought in terms of the goals for land management, how we ought to be managing our lands, a lot of the kind of moral or prudential thinking that they put forth is framed in terms of the populations of wild species. What types of species are there? What kind of numbers? How well do they function? And so on and so forth. So it's an interesting subject, and it's like any subject. You start getting into it, and you get deeper and deeper and deeper. And so I ended up with co-authoring the first law school casebook on wildlife law, and then co-authoring the first ever really survey of wildlife law in the United States. It's astonishing that it was 2009
before
we ever had a single book that offered a survey of wildlife law in the United States.
Wildlife Law Primer that you are the author of came out in 2009. When you talk about a casebook in law, what does that mean?
Sure. A casebook is a book really intended for use in the law school classroom.
Okay.
It's an instructional book. And it will likely have in it the reports of a lot of rulings of appellate courts. So that's what we refer to as cases. I mean, people in the business school have a much different idea of a case. But these would be the rulings of appellate courts. And a lot of the study of law in law school revolves around the careful reading of reports of courts, trying to figure out how the court reasoned, what rules of law were being applied. Look at various cases on the same subject and try to compare and contrast them and so on. So it's a major element of the way law is learned. And the books themselves are collectively referred to as casebooks, although there's lots of notes and statutes and other material in them as well.
Now, when you were a law student at the University of Michigan, I noticed in reading about you at the College of Law, the description of their faculty members, I noticed that you were a honors graduate there, and you edited the Law Review, and those are really quite some distinctions, of course, for a law student. But when you were there, was there an interest then in conservation, and did you ever hear animal law discussed even once?
Certainly not animal law, and maybe we can come back to that, because animal law is not really the same as wildlife law. Some overlaps, but no, certainly not. Certainly environmental law was in its early stages.
It was.
And Michigan at the time had one of the nation's foremost scholars in it, a guy, Joe Sachs.
Oh, really?
Who then went on to Berkeley after some years.
Is that partly that influence of that professor that piqued your interest
in
conservation?
No, it did not. I didn't take environmental law at the time. I wasn't particularly interested in it at the time.
Oh.
I, Maybe there was some latent interest because I had spent a lot of time outdoors growing up. I was a Boy Scout. I was, a canoeing instructor at a National Boy Scout camp and this and that. Oh. So I had a lot of interest in the outdoors, but I hadn't really connected it to the area of law that I was interested in. It wasn't really until I had practiced law for some years and then came back into teaching that
I turned to Indianapolis.
I did practice in Indianapolis for a few years. I actually – my first 4 years of law practice were with the United States Army because I was attended college in the first year of law school on an Army ROTC scholarship.
Oh.
So I owed them 4 years.
Sure.
And because of my record and so on that I was pulled in directly to work in the Pentagon.
Wow.
In the Secretary of the Army's office. So I was there from 1976 to 1980.
Cool.
Working in the Army General Counsel's office and then went on to Indianapolis and practiced there for 3 years. I wanted to get back to the Midwest. I mean, I'm, as you may remember, I'm from Decatur, from Central Illinois, a rare law professor from Central Illinois. Well, there aren't a lot of professors generally at the university here, and we draw them from all over the world and
sure.
are proud of it. But
sure.
a few of us actually are from Central Illinois, and my wife is from Decatur as well. So we were interested in coming back to the Midwest. Indianapolis was a step in that direction, and then we made the move here to Champaign.
Now, as a top 10 in the nation, a public law school, the U of I, of course, has its choice of professors. And as you say, they're drawn from all over the world. Were you flattered to be able to come back to your home region?
Oh, sure. Oh, indeed. It's been a great time. I mean, I have occasionally been off teaching elsewhere. Most recently, just a few years ago, I spent a semester teaching at the University of Michigan.
Uh-huh.
But always happy to get back. I have tended in the places I've gone to teach, have been interested in places that had outdoor areas of interest or something to attract me. So I spent a semester at William & Mary in Williamsburg, Virginia.
And you were recently in New Zealand.
I was in New Zealand, right?
Place,
oh, that was fabulous. Yes, I was honored. I was a distinguished visitor at the University of Auckland there, and I will be visiting in the fall of next year, 2012. I'll be I have a position at the Center for Advanced Study in South Africa outside Cape Town. So I'm hoping we can spend a good 3 months
down
there.
I have visited Cape Town once. I attended the Parliament of World Religions there back in 1999, but it was my first visit to Africa. And we've stopped there and then in Malawi as well. But my, what a beautiful, beautiful part of the world. In terms of your interest in conservation, you mentioned growing up you were in the Boy Scouts and things like that. Was your family a religious family? Did you get any interest in nature or concern with conservation from early religious training?
No, I don't think so. I mean, the answer to your question, yes, somewhat religious. I mean, I actually, of all the family members, was the most regular attender of a Presbyterian church in Decatur.
And now you attend the University Place Christian Church.
Yes, right.
Champaign-Urbana.
Exactly. Very, very active in that. Uh-huh. Very active and have been for, well, the whole time we've been here, which is, you know, over 25 years.
And have you found that having a sort of public, it is a relatively small town, having sort of a public identification with a religious organization has hindered or helped your career as a professor?
I don't think either, really.
Neither.
I mean, I'd have to think about that a bit, but it certainly hasn't hindered it one bit.
It hasn't.
Sure.
Okay.
No. Oh, no. Because really, particularly in the law school classroom, we engage issues from all perspectives. And, you know, when you approach issues of public policy, a lot of people think about them from religious perspectives
sure.
or from other ethical perspectives. So
right.
This is not a place in the university where we shy away from taking stances on tough issues. In fact,
right.
we sort of specialize in
right.
it.
But the university, of course, as a public institution, has a reputation of being a secular place. And there have been decades past when priests and rabbis and pastors would say, well, you should go to a church-related school. You shouldn't go to that big state university. I know, of course, in the Catholic the arguments about whether to form a Newman Center here originally that came up, and bishops and cardinals were discussing should there be a Catholic presence at a state university? What would that do to Notre Dame? You know, or so those kinds of issues are in the past. The Christian Church has been very active on this campus, University Place Church, for years, also with a very strong campus ministry presence on this
indeed.
Campus.
Oh, indeed. Yes, sure.
Well, let's talk about animals. What's the difference between, you mentioned wildlife law and animal law?
Sure. Animal law tends to focus on individual animals as such. Mostly domesticated animals because they've been an object of interest in the law for a long time, companion animals. So it's individual animals as organisms, as beings. Wildlife law tends to focus a lot more on animals in the wild. It's concerned about species, about animal populations. It includes subjects like fish and game laws, hunting. A lot of it focuses on the management of lands to promote wildlife. A lot of federal lands are covered, fish and wildlife refuges, national parks, national forests, grazing lands, other lands, how they're managed. So in terms of conservation, it tends to focus on the management of populations of animals to keep them at what seem to be ecologically sensible levels. So there's not really that much concern about the welfare of individual animals as such. Wildlife law does have some involvement with individual animals, particularly wild animals that people take into captivity. And so it governs about how you can gain rights in wildlife, what liability you might have if you have a wild animal in your possession that hurts somebody, for instance. Sure. So there is some overlap between the two. But as I say, animal law mostly focuses on domestic animals, things that are in captivity. Wildlife law is mostly animals in the wild.
And do you deal with agricultural animals, the whole issue of raising animals for food?
Oh, sure. Well, that would, again, be more in the animal law area. The law of domesticated animals goes back hundreds of years. And livestock, of course, has often been one of the most valuable forms of property there has been, and that remains true around the world very much. And there's a big body of law built up around it about the kind of property rights people have in animals, about contracting them, about putting up your livestock as security for a loan or something. Straying animals, a big body of law there, when you're responsible, if your horse or your cow breaks down somebody's fence and tramples their corn field.
And that goes back even to the Hebrew Bible.
Sure.
Laws about what happens if someone hurts one of your animals.
Right. And that of course, was what animal law mostly focused on. The valuable animals were livestock.
Right.
The law tends to go where the money is. things of value have a lot of law built up around them. Things that have no value, they tend to have virtually no law.
Let me give the phone numbers. This is a live call-in show, of course, every Sunday night here on WILL AM 580 and heard also at 90.9 FM HD3 if you have one of those wonderful HD radios. We're also heard online, of course, live at will.illinois.edu, and our archived programs can be found at that same website. If you'd like to call and ask our guest today, Professor Eric Freifogel, a question about animals, animal law, do give us a buzz. We're eager to have listener participation. 333-9455 is the number. If it's a local call, if it's long distance, use our toll-free line, 1-800-222-9455. And I don't want to confuse callers who would like to be on the show, but there is another number since it is part of our pledge drive for the spring. If you'd like to make a donation to WILL to keep programs like this and others on the air, it's possible to do that by phone. You may call 244-WILL, 244-9455 and area code 217 for pledges. But again, for call-in, 333-9455 or 1-800-222-9455. Eric, in terms of animal welfare, do animals have rights?
A good question and a controversial one. There are certainly some philosophers, ethicists, who take the view that animals ought to have rights. If humans have rights, other organisms ought to have rights as well. The thinking there mostly is that it's relatively hard to draw a sensible line between humans and other life forms. I mean, what is it about humans that make us morally worthy when every other life form, the millions of other species on the planet, have no moral status whatsoever? And so there are some who think it is useful to expand the category of rights-bearing organisms to include at least some other species, typically high-functioning species in terms of mental functioning or neurological functioning. That said, I think the vast majority of writers, though, who show concern about our treatment of animals, I mean people who are interested in animal welfare generally, don't typically use rights terminology to talk about that. They may say animals have some moral value to them, or a term that you see in the academic literature is moral considerability. So I would say animal rights advocates are a subset of the much larger group of people concerned about animal welfare. And even those who do think it's useful to talk about rights held by animals, it's important to note that they're not claiming that animals would have the same rights as humans or that they would necessarily trump human interests at all. But so it's just a different way of talking about the moral status of animals.
We have a caller on line one, a caller from Champaign. Yes, you're on the air with our guest today, Professor Eric Freifogel.
Thank you, Steve. I love your show. Actually, the while I was making my call, your guest started to address the question that I wanted to ask. But I was interested in the issue of animal rights, and in particular in scientific research, but and specifically that, but also more generally about the idea of rights. There was a philosopher who kind of defended the use of animals in research, and he said that animals can't really have rights in the sense that we understand them, because rights are reciprocal. So, you know, if I have the right of freedom of speech, that means I have to extend that right to everyone else. But animals wouldn't understand that in the same way that humans do. I was wondering if the guest would be willing to comment specifically on animals in research, and also on this whole notion of rights and what really is a right, and could animals even could we even speak about animals having rights?
A good lead-in.
Great.
Sure. That certainly is one of the objections to the notion that animals could have rights, is the claim that they really can't appreciate the sense of having duties, that rights need to be reciprocal. That both sides need to be respecting one another. I mean, one of the counters to that, of course, is that we don't seem to have much trouble in our society talking about rights for infants or for comatose people.
Sure.
or for fetuses, or for lots of other people who are not high functioning, mental functioning individuals, or people who are not really in full control of their behavior. We don't seem to have any trouble attributing rights there. And of course, in many legal settings, courts will appoint lawyers to represent somebody who cannot represent themselves. And that's happened in a few animal settings as well. A lot to be said about this notion of rights and where they come from.
What about particularly, as the caller mentioned, in terms of research?
In terms of research,
you know, the university
sure.
does so much research, particularly medical research, biological
sure.
research, using live animals.
Sure. That question really goes more to the content of rights. I mean, if you're going to say animals have rights, well, that doesn't take you very far, because the next question will be, well, what are those rights? And are they sort of unlimited? You would think that if an organism had a right of any sort, it would be a right to life and
sure.
Not being. But that doesn't necessarily follow. And some of the writers who have talked about animal rights actually admit that they can be used by humans, even killed by humans for specific purposes. But maybe they would define the rights in such a way that some types of uses of animals and some types of killing of animals, sacrifice of animals, that doing that for some purposes would be okay, but for other purposes would not be okay. You know, so for serious medical research that can only be done using animals, that might be fine. But for other types of research that perhaps could be done without harming animals, maybe it isn't okay. You know, in the early years when this issue was coming into prominence, a lot of attention was paid to a particular type of test that was conducted on rabbits, I think it was, testing out all sorts of human makeup. They were essentially
right.
blinding the animals. It would see what dosage levels did it take. before 50% of these rabbits were blinded. And often it seemed to outsiders, at least, that these tests were being conducted on way too many animals and rather uselessly. Oh. That is, it was a slightly different color of eye shade or something, and they were still going to be blinding 1,000 rabbits or something just to test this out. But to get back to the question, to say that animals have rights, as I say, is only a starting point. You then have to say, well, what exactly are those rights? And maybe it would be a right not to be abused by humans for relatively trivial purposes.
Uh-huh.
That only if we really need to use them for this purpose should we do so. And actually, if you then apply it to livestock or even meat eating, I mean, some people could take the view that the right of an animal is really more to avoid unnecessary pain. And so that even
that an animal should be slaughtered humanely somehow.
Yes, exactly.
If that's not a contradiction in terms.
If it is not a contradiction in terms. But certainly a lot of animal welfare interests are not opposed to using animals for food or killing them, but want them to be, you know, humanely maintained while they are alive, and they ought to be killed in a way that imposes the least amount of pain and the least amount of anxiety to them. You know, I mean, sort of kill them suddenly when they don't realize it's happening or something like that.
Right.
So it's a fascinating subject and a very rich literature that's worth digging into.
We've lost that caller accidentally. If you'd like to follow up, do call back. The number again is 333-9455 for that caller or others. In the Champaign-Urbana area, if it's a long distance, call 1-800-222-9455. And again, to make a pledge to WILL to help us in our fundraising at this crucial time of the year for our next year funding, do give a call to the number for pledges, which is 244-9455. Or you may pledge online, of course, as Jay Pierce was telling us just at the start of the program, at willpledge.org, willpledge, willpledge.org, to make a very important contribution to this station and its budget. Eric, we were talking a little bit about humane treatment of animals and even how they may be slaughtered humanely. And, of course, in religious traditions, there are several where the slaughter of animals was an offering to God. Are there laws about what religions can or cannot do in terms of the treatment of animals?
It is certainly not a major area of the law. I might back up and say that our laws have included limits on our ability to treat animals cruelly for a long time, animal cruelty statutes, animal abuse statutes. And those – one of the big developments in animal law and even wildlife law generally has been the very considerable expansion of those laws to include protection for a much wider range of animals than in the past, and now for the first time even applying them somewhat to wild animals. But statutes that do ban abuse of animals often do have exceptions for religious practices. They're fairly controversial, though.
Uh-huh. And, of course, the other side of that is some animals are considered sacred or holy in some religious traditions.
Oh, sure. Oh, yes. My goodness. Animals have appeared in various religious traditions in lots of different status, from being highly unclean animals that you don't want to eat or touch to those that are sacred and lots of status, or to those that seem to be kin to us or that have special spirits in them. I'm sure you know a lot more about that than I do.
Well, not much, but some perhaps. We have another caller waiting, though. Let's go to a new person calling on line number one. Yes, you're on Keeping the Faith.
Hi. This is a really deep concern of mine, and that is that the more I keep seeing wildlife run over more and more on city streets, the more we take away wildlife areas and build subdivisions and mini malls, et cetera, the more we take away trees, grass, plants, animals, all of which could be beneficial to us, and we have no idea how they are. It's all part of the chain of nature. I don't think we really understand the benefit of preserving this. That's a big concern of mine.
Thank you for raising that. We'll have our guest respond.
Sure. Well, yes, a number of points that can be teased out of that. These days, for the most part, the major cause of declines in wildlife population is habitat loss. That is, the habitat animals need for living is being degraded by humans in some way.
For agriculture, for development, for housing,
for agriculture, for development, exactly.
Sure.
You bet. If you go back in time some, the major causes included over-harvesting, you know, particularly market hunting of animals. We were just killing too many of them.
The passenger pigeon, for example.
Passenger pigeon being one, yes. These days, wildlife declines are mostly habitat loss and then actually competition by what are called exotic species, species that are not natural to an area, that were not here when humans came in, Europeans at least. They often outcompete a lot of the local ones. But with respect to animals that get hit on the road, of course, that is very sad. I don't mean to sort of put a positive spin too much on it, but one of the things you can say is that when you start seeing a lot of animals that get hit in the road, it likely means that the populations of that species are way up.
Like the deer currently.
Well, deer currently, yes. But there are some species where the populations tend to fluctuate a lot, raccoons or possums or skunks or something or foxes, so that if you suddenly see a lot of them on the road – very dismaying, of course, but it probably means their population is way up.
Perhaps because of natural predators that have been eliminated.
Like foxes, for instance, which you don't often see on the road, but their populations are sort of inversely proportionate with coyotes. It's not good to see. But to tell you the truth, people who really are concerned about wildlife are often more concerned if they don't see a particular species for a long time on the road.
Interesting.
Because that really means that the population might well be very low.
Huh. We have another caller on our toll-free line, line number 4 from Chicago. Yes, you're speaking with our guest, Eric Freifogel.
A two-part question, a related part. I'm wondering if your scholarship in law has had any effect on your own view of animals and a regard for animals. And then the counterpart is whether your own philosophy is or theology is, how do you think it affects your practice or study of law?
All right, stay on the line because we might need to ask you to clarify that. You're asking about whether the professor's research and writing has changed his own personal feelings or regard for animals. Is that part of the question?
That's the first part.
Okay.
Sure, it has. In a way that may be pleasing to some and not so pleasing to others. You know, in our discussion so far, we've talked a little bit about animal welfare, concerns about individual animals. And I noted earlier that wildlife law had a lot to do more with balances of populations, the sort of ecological health of landscapes generally. And in truth, when I think about wild animals, I do so very much from this environmental ecological perspective. And therefore, I am concerned when individual species, the populations of them, get excessively high. Normally, that happens when humans have altered a landscape in a way, removing predators, and you get species that just go up and up in population. White-tailed deer, I think, Steve, you mentioned that one. Canada geese is another one that people are obvious to people. And then a lot of sort of the middle-level predators, possums, raccoons, and so on, a lot of those populations can get really quite high because the higher-level predators that would keep them in check are often gone. I tend to put a very high value in, personally and in my writing on the ecological health of landscapes. And I think it is therefore important that if we humans are going to alter landscapes in a way that leads some populations to go up, we need to step in and perform the role of predators. So I'm, very supportive of hunting, for instance. I think that we really need hunting to control wildlife populations. Better yet might be to try to bring back some of these predators that naturally kept some of these populations in check. But I will say that as I have thought about this, I have really embraced this more environmental ecological perspective, and therefore am More than it ought to, I suppose my view of animals has a lot to do with my knowledge of their population and whether it's high, whether it's low, whether we have too many of them, we ought to get rid of them, whether they're really low, we ought to protect them. If I could just tell a little story about this, that a good illustration. There was a famous question asked by one of the environmental ethicists, asking offering a comparison between a California condor, which is of course a very rare bird, and three turkey vultures. And the question was posed: if you had to kill either the one condor or the three turkey vultures, you know, which would you do? Well, the people who are concerned just about individual animals would say, "Well, we'd want to protect three. Three is more than one." But certainly somebody who cared about rare species, about ecological functioning and so on would say, gee, this condor is worth a lot more than three vultures because it's very rare, it's on the brink of extinction and so on.
Caller, do you want to follow up?
Wouldn't one option be to create public policies that that reduced the impact of, for example, expansions into suburbs and highways and so on, in order to protect species rather than kill them through hunting?
Certainly, yes. That's, of course, a big agenda item. Because I said a few minutes ago, the main cause of species decline really is habitat loss, and that's basically human land uses. To some extent, it's contamination. I mean, all of you will remember the massive declines in bird populations, large birds in particular, that came through the use of some of the pesticides in the 50s and 60s that Rachel Carson wrote about. Well, we've stopped using a lot of those pesticides, and as a result, a lot of the birds whose populations went down have really come back strong. I mean, there's a lot of wonderful success stories about populations rebounding because we have stopped using some of these pesticides.
But springs are not so silent anymore, fortunately.
Springs are not so silent, right, yes. And we've got some great local stories about that, by the way. We want to get off and talking about wild bird populations. We had our first sandhill cranes nesting here this year, the first time since 1872. So we could certainly try to create more landscapes that are suitable for wide ranges of species and that have the full range of wildlife so that they can sort of keep one another in check. Really what's missing, frankly, are the large predators. And when you can bring in large predators, they really do an awful lot to restore the ecological health of landscapes. But it's hard to imagine doing that in a lot of landscapes. I mean, I don't know how we're going to bring in wolves in central Illinois or, you know, big cats or something.
Well, the second part of my question was how your own values, your own philosophy, your own theology, frame of reference affects your study, academic study of the law.
Thank you for that question. We appreciate the call. Thanks.
Goodness, you're putting me on the spot here.
that's the point of a call-in show.
you bet it is. Well, I mean, like other people, I'm concerned about the welfare of individual animals. I don't happen to write a lot about that subject. I don't think a lot about it. I sort of leave that to other people. My own writing is much more ecological, talking about populations, about habitat and the like. I would say my own. I put a high value. I have to like back up a little bit here. I mean, I tend to think of humans as being very much part of natural systems, and our own welfare is in the long run. The welfare of humans generally, collectively, is in the long run dependent upon the ecological health of landscapes. I mean, I think of us as importantly not just as individuals, but as parts of larger wholes. Ecological holes, and that we really ought to be doing more than we are to promote the overall ecological health and functioning of these holes. I mean, that's a lot just to throw out without following up on it. And that's a matter of personal value. It's a matter of intellectual conviction, and it also carries over into my writing a lot. My writing really includes a very strong call to promote what the great conservationist Aldo Leopold decades ago called land health. I mean, I think that land health ought to be the overall aim of our conservation work, and it plays a central role in my own writing and thinking and beliefs.
I want to get back to that in our second part of our program here on WILL AM 580. We have another caller waiting on line one. I want to get to that caller very quickly. But let me take a moment, since we're about halfway through, to say this is Illinois Public Media. It can be heard at 90.9 FM HD3, as well as at WILL 580 AM, and online at will.illinois.edu. And again, to pledge support for this program and others on WILL AM, please make a call with your pledge. The number is 244-9455 and area code 217, or you can go online and do it very simply and quickly at willpledge.org. I'm Steve Shoemaker, the usual host for these Keeping the Faith programs. Next week, we'll be talking by phone with Mark Johnson, who's the National Executive Director for the Fellowship of Reconciliation, the oldest U.S. Peace organization. And we'll be talking about whether there is a sort of a culture of fear of peace internationally. That's June 26th here on Keeping the Faith. On July 3rd, I'll be traveling, and we're going to be playing an archive program on the homeless, mentally ill, that was broadcast last September, an interview with Shirley Stillinger about the homeless, mentally ill. I might say that on that July 3rd date, I'll be listening to a former guest on this program, the jazz saxophone player John Ellis, whose music starts and ends each show. He's bringing his band Double Wide to a jazz festival in Iowa City. And so since I fortunately have one of my brothers who lives there, we're going to be able to go over and hear John Ellis play. Later in July, Rafe Melhado will be our guest, along with his spouse Jessica, talking about their year as providing the leadership for the University of Illinois Hillel Foundation, the Center for Jewish Students here at the University of Illinois. Well, let's get quickly back to call-in. Line number one in Champaign, you're on Keeping the Faith.
Hi there. Thanks for taking my call. I was thinking about what he was just saying a few minutes ago about the spikes in certain populations and how a lot of that problem is due to the fact that there are no longer predators to sort of keep things in check. And while I think it would be pretty neat to see wolves on the prairie again, I don't really see that happening. But my concern is that I'm very much a fan of coyotes and a supporter of coyotes, and I see a value of coyotes in the landscape. But and I think it would help a lot with some of the populations that do kind of spike. But I have a problem because organizations like Natural Resources and other organizations don't seem to put value on the life of a coyote. In fact, I think, people can, there's pretty much open season all the time on coyotes, and I could be wrong. I could be just thinking of certain states, but I've even seen some places where, you know, they get so much money for bringing in the hide of a coyote, and I don't understand how this all kind of adds up, because it seems like those coyotes can help with rodent populations and other populations that tend to give us problems, but we just don't see the value in that, and I'm curious what you think about that situation.
I agree entirely.
Thank you.
I agree on both points, on the ecological role of coyotes, which is considerable, and the fact that conservation groups generally don't pay any attention to them, pay very little attention to them. On the second point, they don't pay attention to most species that are not threatened or endangered. And coyotes are a success story in a sense.
They seem to survive even in urban environments.
They have, first of all, they've spread greatly. They used to be a sort of a prairie wolf, midwestern species, but now they have spread from coast to coast and north and south, largely because of the retreat of the wolves. They have come in where wolves have disappeared. Now, in those areas where wolves have come back, in Wisconsin, the coyote population tends to plummet. They are not able to compete with wolves very, very well. One big role for coyotes that's been written about a lot lately, and I need to be sensitive about this, is to control feral cats, which are very much prey upon birds. You know,
estimates
vary.
You should reveal.
Sure.
You are a birder.
I am a birder. Yes, I'll tell you some stories about that. But yes, one of the you know main threats to birds these days are feral cats, and there are estimates range of like something like 100 million of them in the United States.
Well, let me
and
ask.
One of the few things that keep them under control are coyotes, and therefore coyotes are very helpful in protecting bird populations.
Well, since we have a guest on the line and no one has asked a mean question, that let me ask a mean question to both of you. Our caller said you like coyotes,
yes.
And you like the fact that they kill rodents. What do you have against cute little mice and bunny rabbits?
I don't have anything against them as long as they are not in my house. I even tell the ones out here, if you go out, even go stay in the barn, that's okay, just go be somewhere else, but not in my house. And I think that I've seen an even population. Coyotes don't know the difference between a feral cat and a companion.
That's right. That's
cat.
Exactly right.
And so what I see, I remember in Tolono last year, there was a woman who allowed her cat to roam. I think it was maybe even on her front porch, but still it wasn't protected in her house.
Uh-huh.
And there was a claim that a coyote heard it, and other people get upset because they have their cats outside.
Sure.
Where they could be hurt by anything.
I've read that the average lifespan for a cat that's let outside is 1 year, and if it's kept inside is, what, 12 years, something, a huge,
sure.
huge difference, yeah.
But again, the coyote becomes a scapegoat, and I guess it's different
uh-huh.
animals, but he becomes blamed for, you know, doing what comes natural, and then the cities hire these people to come in and set up traps and, you know, slaughter the coyotes when the coyotes are probably doing a lot more good for the communities by keeping rodent populations down. And if the people would just take responsibility and keep their animals inside where they can be safe from all other kinds of things, then that would be a lot better for the coyotes and for all of us.
Amen. I agree with all of it. Sure, sure. I would say that the same problem comes up also with small dogs. I mean, coyotes, particularly male dogs, male coyotes will go after small male dogs and kill them. There was one just down on my street on the edge, outskirts of Urbana.
Yeah.
There was a small dog that was ripped to pieces by a coyote. Again, you know, if you're going to live out in an area where coyotes are roaming, I would say either keep your pets indoors or get a pet that's big enough that it's not going to be threatened. You know, if you get a dog, get a big dog.
We have a collie and we worry about it because we live in the country and we hear coyotes regularly. And so far, we've been all right, and he's a pretty good-sized collie, but you do worry about those things.
Sure. It's the male one that's going to be endangered.
Right.
Yeah, that would be.
Well, thank you very much for the call.
Thanks.
Appreciate
thanks.
That. Thanks for giving us a call. And let me repeat the numbers for others who'd like to join this conversation. We're always eager for questions and comments and different viewpoints. You don't have to agree with our guest, and he may not agree with you. The numbers again, if it's a long-distance call, 1-800-222-9455. And, of course, we're heard online live, and so you may be somewhere else in the continental U.S. You may use that toll-free line to call this live program. If it's a local call, 333-9455. And I see we have a comment from a listener who's made a comment off air. Let's see. Outdoor or indoor outdoor cats live on average 10 years less than indoor-only cats. It is not a requirement that they need to roam. This is a comment from a board-certified veterinary technologist who points out that my collie would be a risk, especially from a pack. So I'm not sure I can do much about that at this point.
Sure,
but,
right. Coyotes are not distinctly pack animals.
Uh-huh.
They don't hunt in packs the same way wolves do. I mean, they will occasionally do that. But in fact, it would almost be better if they did hunt in packs more because then they could do a better job keeping the deer population down. But uh-huh. as it is, they are not able effectively to take down adult deer. So they will kill fawns occasionally, but... So our adult deer, that's why they really have no predators on our landscape, and that's why their numbers go up.
Let me mention, if listeners have missed part of this program, you may, of course, listen to it online via your computer or portable device at your convenience at will.illinois.edu/keepingthefaith. You can leave the G off of keeping. We are very informal here at WILL. So you can hear this program or other programs previously recorded at that site. Eric, it happens. I wish I could take credit for having planned this carefully, but Genesis 1 was read this morning in many churches that follow the lectionary pattern of reading the scripture in Christian churches. And so in Catholic and Anglican and Lutheran and Presbyterian, many other denominations, they heard the reading this morning that humans were created on day six, and God, in this ancient saga, this ancient story, were given dominion over the animals, over nature, over the plants. Humans have so misused that power. As you've pointed out in your books and on previous interviews on this show and with David Inge on Focus, should humans have been given that freedom by God?
As you know, the statement dominion over animals is one that needs to be unpacked a bit. You know, the word dominion itself needs to be thought about. It is, Genesis was not written in English. The word dominion as such doesn't quite appear there. The term dominion really properly understood is a form of leadership that entails quite a few responsibilities. Sure, it is a superior status, but it one that comes with an obligation to care for those beneath you. So it is sort of a notion of managing, but in a caring way that looks after those who are beneath you. So it certainly doesn't mean you've got unlimited ability just to deal with them as you want and to kill them. I guess I'm not prepared to comment any more on your question.
Well, we have two more questions coming up. Let's go first to line number two, a caller from Urbana. Yes, you're on Keeping the Faith.
Thank you. I had the privilege of attending Professor Fry Fogle's sustainability series for 2 years. And as depressing as it is to hear what we're doing to the earth around us, it's been very instructive and very exciting to have an opportunity to hear experts talk and dialogue among them, and for us to be able to comment and ask questions. And I'm hopeful that it will happen again next spring. I just want to say thanks.
Where was that series offered?
It was offered at the University of Illinois, and it included students and town people.
All right. It was a 10-part series offered in the spring this year and last year as well, and it was open to the public. And we had pretty good attendance.
And who offered it at the university?
It was offered by the Office of Sustainability, okay, which is out of the campus office. But then was, co-sponsored, and I was sort of the ringleader of it out of the law school. And there were students who came to it from various courses around campus as part of the requirements of different courses.
Well, thank you for that vote of confidence. Appreciate the call. And we have another caller waiting on line number one. Yes, you're on the air with Professor Eric Freifogel.
Hi. My question is for your thoughts about extending the life of domesticated animals. I know at the university here they even have cancer treatments for dogs and cats. And I'm just wondering what your thoughts are. It used to be, when I was a kid on a farm, when an animal got sick, they were put down. And from my point of view, I'm not sure that a dog or a cat or a domesticated animal has the ability to understand why they are going through what they're going through. And I'm just curious about your thoughts, and I'll listen off air. Thanks.
Thank you for the call. A very easy question.
Goodness.
How much should the School of Veterinary Sciences extend the lives of animals that are very sick, that are pets?
I think we'd be better off if the person who called in addressed this subject. I'm thinking she knows a lot more about it than I do and has thought a lot more about it. Yeah. Certainly, we're talking about companion animals. Annual animals where there's been a tremendous emotional bond between the owner and the animal. So it's obviously this is being done. To be frank, it's being done for the welfare of the human owner of the animal.
Right.
I don't know what to say. a lot of people are critical of this just because the amount of economic resources that goes into it. You know, couldn't this money be better spent?
Sure.
You know, shouldn't you be using the money to support, you know, hungry humans somewhere on the planet or something, you know? But paying for inoculations of humans, why lavish so much health care on animals? I'm not one to criticize that too much because I would be prone to want to compare an expenditure like that with other ways that people spend their money. And, you know, a lot of people spend money very foolishly, and I wouldn't probably rank this high on the list of foolish expenditures. So
you get more pleasure from your television set than you do your dog or cat.
Or whatever.
Right.
Yes. Yeah. So, I mean, you certainly could analyze it in ethical terms, in terms of the pain and suffering of the animal itself. If you're prolonging animal's life and the animal is in a great deal of pain.
What's the quality of that animal's life?
That there actually may be real moral objections to that.
If your
moral calculus takes into account, as it does with many philosophers, the pain and suffering of animals themselves. So that it becomes a very, very difficult moral calculation.
And it's a very practical question for any owners of pets because they eventually age and the last years of their life, you have to make decisions about the quality of their life, and you're making decisions for that animal.
Sure.
And I think often we treat animals better at the end of their lives than we treat people. You may not want to talk about that either.
Sure. Well, it's all about resources. You know, there's people with money in the world and people with no money. And, healthcare varies hugely for people. And
Let's talk a little bit about another area of your concern in your publication. You've written a lot about the land and its health and we've talked previously on this show, and listeners who might want to hear that discussion in more detail could go to that archived program. But you wrote a book recently called The Land We Share, Private Property and the Common Good, and you wrote about finding the common good in a book you wrote on private property. There's so many ethical issues that deal with not only animals but plants in terms of private property. We do have the right in this country, of course, to develop land, to use it as we choose. We have various government agencies that are involved in those decisions. What are some of the main concerns you have on that issue?
Again, I would start off by inviting people to think about landscapes at the large scale.
The health
and what it takes for them to provide good places for humans to live over the long term. I mean, what are the attributes of a landscape that is going to be a good place for us to live in the long term? And if you start down that path of inquiry, you're going to look at water flows. You're going to pay a lot of attention to soil, keeping it in place, keeping it fertile, to the cycles that maintain soil fertility. I mean, almost all terrestrial life starts from the soil. And if you look back in history, the civilizations that have gone down because they've misused nature, the main way they have done so is misusing their soils. The health of a landscape also is going to be dependent in complex ways upon the wild animals that are there, the mix of species, the populations, because they actually they play critical roles in maintaining soil fertility. A lot more to be said about that as well. And so placing as I do a lot of emphasis upon the ecological health of landscapes, that forms the backdrop when I then turn to talk about private property rights in nature. You know, what should it mean to own a tract of land? If, in fact, it is in our common interest collectively and in the future for future generations to live on land without degrading it, that, you know, again, I mentioned Aldo Leopold's name before, probably our foremost conservation writer in the 20th century. He referred to this as the oldest task in human history, to live on it on land without degrading it. You know, if we think that is our charge, if that's the way we ought to be exercising dominion over the earth, then our property rights scheme ought to reflect that, that when we turn a parcel of nature over to a person and say, all right, you are going to be the owner of this, you are going to be the one who gets to use it and decide who uses it, that could come with strings attached. I mean, the requirement could be, yes, you can use it, you can use it in various ways, but you have to choose a way to use it that will help sustain the ecological health of the larger landscape of which it is a part. And that really would be a fairly major change in our thinking, because to a large extent in recent generations, the last few centuries, that we have often taken the view that if you own something, you can destroy it, you can degrade it, you can consume it completely. There's a lot of exceptions to that rule, by the way. If you think about historic buildings, for instance, there's often limits there. And wildlife, of course, is another good example. We have a lot of animal cruelty statutes that are passed that actually impose limits on what owners can do to their animals. More and more animal cruelty statutes are, of course, limiting the way people can interact with animals. Essentially what I'd be proposing is that we consider doing the same thing with respect to other parts of nature. I mean, again, I emphasize the importance of topsoil, for instance. You know, should the owner of land be able to use it in a way that erodes the soil or degrades it so that the land becomes vastly less fertile and productive for a future owner, for future generations? You know, should we instead be viewing current owners more as stewards who have the opportunity to use land but under an obligation to use it so that it remains healthy for future users as well? So a lot more to be said about that.
What do you think about the typical suburban lawn?
Well,
a monoculture that looks beautiful and like the green of a golf course.
Right. Well, if you come to my lawn, you'll see a lot of weeds in it would be nice if we could shift to modes of lawn management that weren't so chemical intensive. Lawn care companies, you may well know, put on far more fertilizer than we need. A lot of it runs off. It joins fertilizer from farmlands as well to create one of our biggest water pollution problems in the country as a whole.
The preservation of water is probably the crucial issue for
the
next 100 years.
Sure. The fertilizer runoff, I mean, on a per acre basis, people who treat lawns put on vastly more fertilizer and pesticides of various sorts than do farmers. But
herbicides,
of course, herbicides, yes. Yeah. But farmers, of course, treat far more acres. So, the farm problem is on a per acre basis not so bad, but on overall basis a lot worse. But everybody hears about the Gulf hypoxia problem, dead zones and estuaries that are expanding. But overloading our waterways with nitrogen, overloading the biosphere generally with nitrogen, is a vastly more serious environmental problem than we realize. That's not the least of the problems with the great old American lawn.
Well, we're going to have to end there. We are out of time. I want to thank our guest today, Professor Eric Freifogel from the University School of Law, where he has been a professor since the early 80s and holds a named chair there. We're happy to have him as our guest today, talking about animals and nature. I want to thank also our callers for their many good questions and comments. Next week here on Keeping the Faith, I'll be talking with Mark Johnson from the Fellowship of Reconciliation that tries to bring about peace around the world with some very creative and progressive projects. We'll be talking about whether there is a fear of peace internationally. That's June 26 here on Keeping the Faith. And again, July 3rd, we'll be replaying a program from last September 12, an interview with Shirley Stillinger about her experience very personally with dealing with the homeless mentally ill. That will be July 3rd. I'm Steve Shoemaker, the usual host for these Keeping the Faith programs. Thank you for listening, and do remember to make a pledge at willpledge.org or by calling 244-9455 to make a pledge. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Keeping the Faith, the production of WILL AM 580. The opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants.
Become a friend of WILL today by visiting our website at willpledge.org. You'll fill out some basic information like how much you want to give and whether you want to select a thank you gift. And paying with a credit card allows your dollars to go to work for WILL right away. We accept Visa, MasterCard, Discover, and American Express. That address is willpledge.org. And thanks.
For a snapshot of life in East, Long 150 face the same issues, concerns, and joys of life we all face.
This is home. This is home. This is home.
Yeah. Listen all this month for stories from our trip, from rail trails and dirt tracks to churches, stores, and farms. Life on Route 150 on Morning Edition from Illinois Public Media.
This is Illinois Public Media, WILL 580 AM and 90.9 FM HD3, Urbana.
When his dad moved to